is another episode of Connecting the Dots podcast. I'm Skip Stewart, Vice President and Chief Improvement Officer at Baptist Memorial Healthcare.
Hey, everybody. I'm H.F. Mason. I'm a General Surgeon and Chief Quality Officer for Baptist Memorial Healthcare.
And I'm Brad Parsons, Vice President of Market Operations at Baptist.
Well, folks, we have a special guest today. Many of you will already know our guest. It's LaVon Medlock. And LaVon recently did a wonderful presentation at the LEI conference around coaching and questions. And her and I talked and we said, why don't we talk about what are effective questions? So we're going to call this Asking Effective Questions. But before we jump right into that conversation, LaVon, would you tell our audience a little bit about yourself and about your background?
Sure. Good morning. Thank you, Skip, for having me and Dr. Mason and Brad. So glad to be with you all today. My name is LaVon Medlock, and I've had about a 20-year career in healthcare, currently working for a 4-hospital, 30-clinic health system in Central Oregon, so out in the beautiful Pacific Northwest, where in the middle of April, we're expecting snow today. And I've been on a lean journey for about 10 years now, formally, but lean actually found me when I was a small business owner about 20 years ago. My background is in healthcare. I have an undergrad degree from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill in public health, and then my master's degree in healthcare administration from Oregon Health Sciences University. But along the way, I took a little detour to have some kids and raise them and owned a little business of my own in the luxury income sector right around the time that the economy crashed in 2008. And there is nothing like being in that position to learn about operational efficiency very quickly. So terms like first in, first out, I did not actually know what they were. I was just operating under them to keep the business afloat and keep people paid. But about 10, maybe 12 years ago, the health system that I work for brought on site catalysis, which I'm sure you all are probably familiar with, and thus began my formal training and education in lean. So I have been a teacher and coach of John Shook's Managing to Learn for A3 Thinking for a little over a decade now. And I've also been doing some, that's my favorite book right there. And I've also been doing some recent teaching specifically around Edgar Schein's work on the 4 types of questions. The Ohio State University's MBOE program has actually had me on site a couple of times to teach this as part of their graduate course of study. And I've also been using it to anchor a coaching workshop that, as Skip just mentioned, I offered at the LEI Summit in Houston about a month ago. So that's just a little bit about me.
Well, LaVon, once again, thank you so much for being here. And, you know, knowing that you're a Tar Heel, I'm having to resist the urge to ask your thoughts about Bill Belichick coaching at Chapel Hill. But that'll be another conversation. But when we talk about questions, how many times have we heard somebody ask a question and somebody stops and says, well, you know, that's a good question. And most of the time, it may not even be a good question. And in your 20 years of experience, what are some of the most common mistakes that we as leaders make when we are asking questions or think we're asking good questions, but they may not be?
I think it's really important to think about in any context the need for urgency versus whether there's an opportunity to coach. So there might be contexts in which if there's, for example, a safety risk at play, that is an opportunity to perhaps lead by being a little bit more directive. But in our culture, I think we rely a little too heavily on advocacy, and we think we're asking questions when what we're actually doing is telling people what to do. Yep. The art of asking a great question is actually fairly elusive because the intonation is that we don't have an answer in mind. So I would challenge the listeners to think about when was the last time you actually asked a question for which you did not already have an answer in the back of your mind. So that's probably the first tell in terms of, are we truly asking a good question or are we just leading with what we think is the solution or the one answer?
Yeah, LaVon, that's a great comment to get our conversation started. You know, at Baptist, we've spent a lot of time on humble inquiry, which is part of Ed Schein's work. And right. in our training, we talk about that very thing. So asking questions that we don't already know the answer to. So I appreciate you calling that out. And I know our listeners will appreciate that as well. I'm always, when we have a podcast like this, HF, I'm always worried about asking good questions when we're supposed to be talking about asking good questions. You know, so I don't know, as we record this podcast, Lavanna, I'm curious if you would share with our listeners, how do you start? I mean, and where do you go to make sure that in conversations, and let's say there's conversations with people that you work closely with that may be underneath your leadership, where do you begin to know whether you're asking the right questions?
So I've heard the term asking good questions and asking right questions a couple of times in our moments together already today. And I'm going to say something controversial. The workshop is entitled Asking Effective Questions, specifically because good and right come with a level of judgment attached to them.
I love it.
And so when you ask, where do we start? One of the places we start by not feeling like there is the right question or a good question. We actually start, in my very humble opinion, with listening. So the ability to listen, actively listen to what is being shared with us by our coachee or the person on our team or who we're in conversation with is actually a developed skill because most of us are primed to already be thinking about our answer. And if we're already thinking about our answer, we're not actually there in service of the person that we are coaching. So when I'm in these sessions, one of the things I try to do and try to build a habit around is listening deeply, because until I hear what they have to say, I don't know what question they need, which is very uncomfortable for a lot of people and takes some time to build skill around.
I love it before, Lavanna, when you said that, there are times when you need a direct answer right then and there, and you don't have time to coach. But that's probably most of the time that's the exception rather than the rule. And it seems to me that is what you're saying is that it's not the destination. It may not be the answer that you're trying to get to. It's the journey and the development of that person as a leader as you're asking those questions. Is that a fair statement or?
Yes. And Dr. Mason, I would say that part of what we're doing when we are coaching people to develop a better questioning practice is to actually help them build new neuropathways in their brain around the types of questions they ask. Because if we have built habit around questions that are tells with a question mark after it, we're not actually building that practice of a what or how question. You know, it's usually a have you thought of doing this or why did you do that, as opposed to what have you thought of doing, which actually creates the conditions for people to think and learn and grow. And it's actually challenging if we have deep practice and deep brain chemistry that takes us to a place of question, answer, question, answer, question, answer, because perhaps for some of us, that's what we've been rewarded with our entire careers is in having the answer. So I do think that part of it is when you're working with an individual, understanding where they are in their practice of asking effective questions and just creating the space for them to be able to think about what would be the next question based on what was just offered. So it's less about question, answer, and it's more about the dialogue where you're paying attention to what is being presented to you and responding to that, as opposed to something that you kind of preloaded in your brain already.
You know, HF, we've had this other experience that we're working on, but one of the things that we're really honing in on, Lavanna, is allowing leaders time and space to think. And I love that we've gotten to this in this conversation with you. I think that it's easy to forgo time to think, pause, and reflect on what needs to be accomplished versus just being on the hamster wheel, per se, of just continuing to do the next thing. I'm wondering if that resonates with you in how we ask effective questions.
It does, and it does particularly within the context of healthcare, right? If we think about how a physician or a provider interacts with their patient, you know, if we're thinking about the H&P, when they're asking those questions, they're listening for the response before the next question comes. And that then helps determine what the diagnoses might be based on what diagnostics you might run. But you don't just decide what diagnostics you're going to run until you've asked those H&P questions and really listened to those answers, because those might lead to more questions. So it's not unlike that relationship between a clinician and a patient, where the patient leads them really is based on the dialogue that they have in that interaction between provider and patient. So I kind of draw that parallel for folks when I'm teaching within the healthcare context, because if you think about an A3, the left side is essentially an H&P left side. Mm-hmm. And if you think about an A3, the diagnostics are basically your countermeasures and your plan, right? So mm-hmm. it's something that our physicians
never
and our
thought
providers
of it that way,
have been,
yeah.
Yeah, they've been trained on it.
I love that example. Mm-hmm. I haven't thought about that either. We talk about A3s a lot, Levon, so I love hearing that. Please expound on that. I mean, you tell us more.
Yeah, no, I'm so glad that that's been a bit, hopefully a bit of a light bulb moment, because I think we put A3s as a tool, but really it's just a framework for thinking, which is not unlike the H&P, which is a framework for thinking. So you will never catch me say, fill out the box, fill out the template, because it is not about the box. It is not about the template. It is about the thinking that underpins what you're gathering from your current conditions. That's not unlike when a provider is sitting down with a patient and gathering their health history and understanding what their symptoms are and filling out sort of that left side of the H&P, because they might do a visual assessment that would lead them down a diagnostic path that's very different from what they would decide to do diagnostically from speaking to that person, right? So it's that interaction. There's just no way that I know of. Don't want to speak in absolutes, but no way that I know of where you can substitute for that interaction and how it informs what we do next. And it's sort of that the same as like with an A3, where, you know, you run countermeasures, you learn something new, you might need to toggle back to that left side. You run an MRI, you might learn something, you might need to toggle back to that left side. So it's very similar in my mind, and it's usually the parallel that I draw when I talk with folks who practice in medicine, because it seems to resonate with folks.
Levon, when thinking about an effective question, and mm-hmm. and we've mentioned humble inquiry as, you know, asking questions that you don't know the answer to, but sometimes in a coaching session, you know the answer. Mm-hmm. But is what you're trying to do is you're trying to get that person, the person that you're coaching or helping, to get to that answer on their own through their own thought processes and their own thinking. Is that, I mean, that's where you do know an answer, but is that still an effective question?
It's a great question. Oh, it's a great question. I just put judgment on your question there. See, we all do it even after 20
yeah,
years
sure
of practice.
Do.
I have to catch myself. So I hear what you're saying, Dr. Mason, and I think that it depends on the context of the coaching. So let's just use the example of catchballing an A3. If you're catchballing an A3 with someone on your team, pure humble inquiry questions, that first type of question that Dr. Schein details in his books, it can support everything from title to the goal statement. Right. So one check for us as coaches is, are we using pure humble inquiry questions to ensure that the problem owner understands their problem deeply, not that we understand their problem deeply? But when we get to the point of root cause analysis, those diagnostic questions actually are very common and useful. But we need to draw a line between the diagnostic questions, which are, how do you know what you know with evidence? And what Schein calls the prompting questions or the confrontational questions, which are, I am confronting you with my thinking, which creates a different response especially if you are looking at a coaching relationship where there's a hierarchy, right? We as humans are wired to want to kind of keep things in balance, but in any organization that has an org chart with little boxes where there's lines and other boxes, there's automatically a hierarchy where we have to be very aware of giving face to the coachee so that we don't lose that relationship. So those prompting questions, the this is my thinking with your with a question mark at the end of it, we really need to put those on the back burner and try to stay true to pure humble inquiry and diagnostic questions when appropriate. So Dr. Mason, when you think about how do I get them to this place, diagnostic questions may very well be suitable. It just depends on whether they've demonstrated through your pure humble inquiry exchange that they understand the current condition, right? Where we get kind of tricky is where they haven't demonstrated understanding of the current condition and we start prompting them to accelerate the pace at which they can, we think, learn. But that's not actually helping because it's robbing them of the opportunity to learn and our ability to scale problem solvers across the organization.
Yeah, one of the things that I'm thinking about, LaVon, as you're as we're having this great conversation is our ability as leaders to use effective questions to help be a good coach on all the things that we want to accomplish by way of how we think, by way of principles for continuous performance improvement or principles of our people principles in the culture domain. Effective questions can really lead us to be better leaders by and large. And I think we sometimes don't have that lens of really being thoughtful about the questions that we're asking and what they say about us as leaders. And I think that's a helpful lens with which to take this conversation and really think about. I'm going to be thinking about this for a while because we ask lots of questions.
Yeah.
And oftentimes they're probably not as thought out as they should be.
Yeah, one of the practice sessions that I run, the way that I actually practice this when I teach this workshop is actually facilitated catchball, where you have a problem owner and you have the coach or the reviewer. But I introduce a third role, that of the observer, where their only job is to write down exactly what comes out of the reviewer's mouth, verbatim. Because that is evidence that we can hand back to that person, not through a lens of what I think you said or what I heard you say, but what you actually said. And then that gives you concrete feedback from which to develop your practice. So I came about a lot of what you're hearing in this podcast, a lot of my training is attributed to my coach and mentor, Margie Hagney. Right? She was my teacher. She continues to be my teacher and my friend. And when I was learning to teach John Shook's A3 Thinking workshop, Margie would sit in the back of the room and on a little post-it, she would have yes and no. And every time I asked a yes, no question, she would throw a hash mark on that post-it and I would get that feedback during a break. She would say nothing else, but that's all that I needed to be able to course correct and be given evidence in the moment of the types of questions I was asking so that I could model for the group that I'm teaching what effective questions look like. And to this day, I've already done it once in this podcast. I will catch myself falling back into those old patterns. And now what I do simply is label it, acknowledge it, and correct, because it's going to happen. And people need to know that that's normal, that's human. It doesn't mean that we can't just acknowledge it and show what better looks like, because it's about being a little bit better every time we practice.
LaVon, how does a way that a leader asks questions either create an environment or maybe even hinder an environment where people are willing to tell the truth? And I'm sure. I'm not meaning that people intentionally are lying to you, but they may not be giving you all the information. They're just giving you what they think that leader or person might want to hear.
omission isn't the same thing as lying, right? So not saying it is not the same. Yeah. So within quality and safety in particular, Dr. Mason, I'm sure you can appreciate just the importance of psychological safety as sure. we discuss this. So psychological safety overlaps deeply, in my opinion, with asking effective questions, questions that create safe thinking spaces, questions that draw out from people what they know or what they believe and how they know it or why they believe it. And it doesn't encourage the questioner to be a teller. And I think all of those things become really important when we start thinking about how do we create conditions where leaders can ask better questions that draw out the human potential of the people on their team, the expertise of them being in the Gemba and doing the work. The more we tell, the more we prompt, the more we confront, the less we create conditions where people perhaps are willing to share freely. And I think it's also important, not so much about the question, but how we react after we get the answer, right? So there is the whole venue of coaching, asking effective questions, psychological safety, but then there's also the very real, what do people fear? And how does that fear potentially show up in how they then perform? So being really careful about how we respond after a question is answered, especially if we don't like the answer, I think becomes really important. And what I found to be really helpful is this beautiful thing we have called silence, which again, doesn't necessarily mean that we can just hold space for people and arrange our faces so that holding that space is safe, so that folks aren't feeling like there will be retribution or punishment for being honest, because that's where that fear might start to come into play. The other thing that I would suggest in terms of how do we draw people out is, again, honing in on that listening skill. So if you are hearing, you know, if you're at a stand-up huddle and you're hearing a story and it appears to you there's a jump in logic or a jump in fact, or there's a conclusion being drawn where that line isn't clear to you, just asking a question about that to get clear on it can start to draw out things that might be in that black box of facts that someone just wanted to jump over so that they wouldn't have to talk about it. But you can only do that if you're listening deeply to what they're saying, not necessarily getting ready to ask them a question.
Hey, LaVon, I've noticed that. Yeah, well, I really like that a lot. And what I was going to say is that I've noticed in your first couple responses, you had a very intentional pause before you answered. Mm-hmm. And I think I really appreciated that. And I think that we should allow for more of that. I really liked your comment about silence. We're just not accustomed to it. And so it's a race to kind of fill the void sometimes.
The awkward silence.
Yeah, but really,
I have sweaty palms right now. Let's be totally honest. I've been doing this for 10 or 15 years now, and I still, that thoughtful pause, I appreciate that, Brad, and I'm sorry to have talked over you. I apologize, but I got really excited there. And I wanted to normalize that, yes, it is awkward. There is a lot of research that shows that it takes us humans, takes our brains, anywhere from 6 to 8 seconds to formulate a question or a response. So when I teach teams, when I lead workshops, I ask a question, usually as part of my opening, and then I will stand there and count to 10, as sweaty as it makes me. And to this day, it still does. And then I'm very transparent with people. I'm like, hey, sweaty palms, just like I did with you all. Because again, it normalizes that. It takes down that hierarchy. Not that I have hierarchy with anyone on this call, but when you're in a classroom, even that relationship can be considered sure. hierarchical. So what are we sure. doing to build face intentionally with the interactions we're having with folks? And then over time, just like anything else that we practice, we get good at it. Like I haven't necessarily thought about in this conversation stopping to think. It's just the way I show up now because I've built that habit over a period of time.
Yeah, no, I love that the habits that you've built from intentional practice. And so, again, I think a lot of leaders that listen to our podcast on a regular basis are always looking for practical ways that they can take what we talk about into their everyday practice. And I think this is a really good one to kind of pause, to allow yourself to count. You said counting to 10, which can feel like way more than 10 seconds when you're doing it. Right, LaVon?
Mm-hmm. Yep. And what I will offer is that we as adults, and especially folks that work in healthcare, we tend to perform, right? Like, we are comfortable being good at things. But if we think about when we were 8 or 9 years old and we were kicking a soccer ball around, or, you know, my daughter plays volleyball or tennis, you know, we didn't expect to be good at it. We had that grace of, hey, I'm learning something new. So allowing ourselves as adult learners, because we're all learning every day that, you know, the eyes open and the ticker ticks is an opportunity to learn. Giving ourselves that grace to say, today I'm going to practice this one thing. We don't need to boil the ocean. We don't need to be perfect at everything. But what is the one thing that today and for the next 30 days I'm going to practice with intention? And how will I know? So at the end of the day, how will I know if I did that thing today?
Yeah.
And what will I learn from so I can adjust? It's my own little PDSA cycle every day, right? And we're going to do one thing for 30 days. We're not going to do 12. Because we're probably not going to get very far if we try to do 12 things, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's that, like, what's the one thing? What's the one thing we can get better at?
Hey, LaVon, I got another question for you. So I love how you started, and I'm curious about this a lot today. You said that Lean found you. And,
yes.
And again, I've got a similar story, but it's you know, once it's found you, then you really show up and you choose to lead in a different way going forward. So what do you say to a leader that still may be searching for, or maybe, you know, is trying to find a way to manage, a way to lead in a way that gets continual or sustainable results? What advocacy would you give this kind of thinking pattern?
I'm going to offer you a structural response first, because there's a condition that must be true. Okay. As an organization, if your incentive program and the way you reward people doesn't align with continuous improvement, you are automatically going to be in tension with developing that attribute in folks. So in terms of how do we develop lean leaders and thinkers, there has to be alignment between the way that structurally the organization rewards its people and how they're expected to show up. It's much less likely to be successful if there's a disconnect in our incentive program and how we recognize folks. If we're going to recognize the people that are the heroes that wear the capes because they save the day, we're not actually honoring those that work slowly and steadily behind the scenes to create higher reliable processes, because that's not flashy and it doesn't get to wear the cape for the day. Right. So I will just say, like, that has to be, you know, a condition that I think needs to exist. And then I would say for a leader that's trying to kind of find their way, there's lots of facets of lean. And I think sometimes folks get very caught up in the tools, I think, because the tools are tactile and you can fill out leader standard work and know whether you did it or not. Or you can, you know, go to your huddle and you can check that box. But it is the underlying behaviors and habits that will actually create transformation. So as much as you might have all of the tools, and the tools are important, I don't mean to understate their value. I just think that in a vacuum without leader behaviors associated with them, we won't be successful in the long run. So as a lean leader, I would think about, what are my opportunities for improvement? Skip had mentioned at the beginning that I just taught a 2-day workshop at the Lean Summit last month. We spent the afternoon of the second day on a personal development A3. So we spent the first day and the morning of the second day gathering the current condition on, what are my behaviors? What are my habits? What types of questions do I ask? And then we used all of that to help populate the left side of the A3 where the person then had an actual action plan that they could work on for 30, 60, 90 days to see what one or two things they wanted to improve upon.
Well, LaVon, that was fantastic, LaVon. Wow, we could go a lot longer. I loved how you got into the art, into the science of asking effective questions. I think I've said many times to Brad, where he's probably tired of me saying it, but when we would spend so much time with Ed Schein, it felt like we were doing an autopsy on what a conversation is. Mm-hmm. And so that was really good, LaVon. I can tell you, as someone that had a deep friendship, Ed Schein would love to hear your line of thinking today. So on that note, LaVon, thank you so much for coming on, connecting the dots. I'm hoping that you'll consider coming on again in the near future. We would love to have you come back and share your thinking with us, but we are so grateful for you and the work you're doing and for the patients that you're serving there out west. And we're just so grateful for you. Thank you so much, LaVon.
Oh, it's been my honor. Thank you all for having me today. Genuinely, I'm so glad to have been here. It was fun.
Thanks, LaVon.